Up next, as part of WNYC's series on climate change, we find out how green buildings can save energy and money on Please Explain. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast.
WNYC is supported by ThinkMap, maker of the visual thesaurus, which The New Yorker calls the best recent advance in reference technology, with an animated display of words and meanings. The visual thesaurus helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. The Jewish Museum, presenting free Saturdays, free admission to current art exhibitions, including Dateline Israel, new photography and video art, The Jewish Museum, 5th Avenue at 92nd Street, and thejewishmuseum.org.
Mel Brooks gave Gene Wilder his big break and the producers, forging a partnership that made an indelible mark on American comedy.
The filthy, vulgar things are all Mel's. All the funny, subtle things are mine.
Gene Wilder on his long acting career and his life now as a novelist. Next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI.
This Saturday at 4 on 93.9 WNYC.
Buildings use 33% of our nation's energy. A UN report yesterday claimed that better architecture and energy savings in buildings could do more to fight global warming than all the decreases in greenhouse gases agreed to in the Kyoto Protocols. Architects and engineers have been working out ways to make buildings more environmentally friendly, and building green is our subject on today's edition of Please Explain. Joining me now are Bill Browning, a founding member of the United States Green Building Council's Board of Directors. He's a principal in Terrapin Bright Green, a strategic environmental consulting firm. Also, Jamie Backus, an LEED accredited professional engineer. We'll find out in a moment what that means. He lectures at NY Designs at the City University of New York and at Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. Very pleased to welcome both of them to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks. Great to be here.
Jamie, what does it mean to build a green building?
To build a green building is really to address all of the social, political, and economic factors that are kind of coalescing right now in today's world. Things that were ignored regarding energy consumption, that largely ignored since the 70s, and also looking at the social activism type of issues that are coming to the fore as far as labor practices, material resource depletion and reductions, habitat destruction, all of these things, and greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to global warming, taking all these things and bundling together to realize that there's a better way to build.
So there, you have to include all of those things? You can't just do one or two?
You really do. You really can't go about this as a one-sided, one-dimensional problem, because it is so far-reaching that things that we're doing here in the U.S. are depleting resources in faraway countries, whether it's the fuel sources from those or from materials that we're taking as far as wood and other things that we're importing into this country.
I promised to ask you what LEED means. How does it apply to determining what a green building is?
LEED is a rating system that was created by the U.S. Green Building Council. Which
there are other systems too, aren't there?
There are. And in fact, the U.S. was not the first to do this. We just like to think we do it the best. But LEED stands for Leadership and Energy and Environmental Design. And it's part of a rating system that Bill helped co-found.
So, Bill, can you walk us through a green building? What's different in each area? Maybe we should begin with where the building is located.
Well, you want to, if possible, put it near transit so that people can walk and don't have to drive, and near multiple uses as well, so that, if possible, you can live near where you work and reduce the amount of fuel consumption getting to the place. Also looking at, are we putting it in the middle of pristine habitat that we could be preserving, or can we build it on an abandoned industrial site, a brownfield, to clean that up and use that as a construction site? And so LEED looks at how you interact with the site, and your choice of sites as well is one of the areas in LEED.
And it, since I would want to be in a sunny place, would that be important? Because I'm assuming that the more light I get, the less electricity I'm using.
Oh, daylight is great. Daylighting is gives you multiple benefits. Obviously, you can lower your energy use, not having to run all the lights all the time. But additionally, people can see better, and quite frankly, the evidence is starting to gather that people are healthier in daylit buildings as well.
What about materials used?
Well, materials have several implications. First, you know, how do we get the materials? Where are they coming from? What's the impact of making them? How much energy does that use? What sort of pollutants do we create? How does it affect the health of the workers installing them? And then when they're in the building, are they off-gassing volatile organic compounds that would negatively affect the health of the people in the building?
And do most buildings do that?
Some do. Some materials do.
Most.
Really? You mean the house I live in, if it's not green, is likely sending off all sorts of gases that might be harming? I always wondered why I have such a bad cough.
When was the last time you painted your home or brought in a new carpet or maybe a new shower curtain, a PVC shower curtain, and you just had that smell for days, weeks later? Those are volatile organic compounds. It's off-gassing of the materials that you brought into your home.
So it's good not to paint and to keep the same old carpet.
If you're going to repaint or if you're building a new project, use products that are designed with less pollutants in them or no pollutants in them. We've known for decades since high school biology that formaldehyde is harmful to people and certainly works great as a preservative. But it's used in a lot of wood products. You're bringing it into your home whether you know it or not. So it's being an educated consumer to buy products that do not have harmful contaminants in them. And when we look at the operation of green buildings, we'll create a green building. But then you have to realize when you the upgrade, the ongoing maintenance of that building, that you don't keep doing the typical standard practices that will pollute the indoor environment of it.
My guests on Please Explain today are Jamie Backus and Bill Browning. We're talking about green buildings. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So with that in mind, Bill, I'm assuming air ventilation should be a real concern.
Yeah, well, first you want to reduce the amount of pollutants and make sure that, you know, when you're cleaning your space, you're not using toxic chemicals that are putting additional pollutants in, and then have a good ventilation system with good filtration. In a home, make sure you're changing the filter. That makes a difference in the indoor air quality there. And also look out for making sure that you're getting ventilation so you're not getting mold and mildew building up. Because that microbial growth can lead to some pretty nasty stuff.
Now, I've heard that water capturing using rainwater is one of the determinants of a green building. So you have to get your own water?
You don't have to get your own water, but you should certainly be aware of where it's coming from. Whenever you turn on a faucet here in the city, you're using potable water, drinkable water, to flush a toilet, to fill a pot, whatever you might use to irrigate. Doorman in front of buildings along my street are using potable water to wash off the sidewalks.
Well, what choice do we have when we turn on the faucets? That's the only kind of water we get.
Well, if you look at the Bank of America Tower that's under construction right now and the corner of 42nd and 6th, that building will capture all the rainwater that falls on that over the course of a year. And that's about 4 feet of water per year on every square inch of that building. And so that's an enormous amount of water. And then the building captures that in storage tanks hidden in various parts of the building and uses that water for flushing toilets and for mechanical systems and things like that.
Although I would have thought that rainwater would be pretty pure. It would be potable all by itself, wouldn't it?
No. You would, years and decades ago, it probably was. If you're familiar with acid rain and the pollutants coming out of the sort of rust belt of America in the Ohio Valley area, our rainwater is not drinkable on its own.
Well, Bill, you talked about the Bank of America building. That's the one at 1 Bryant Park?
Correct.
And
correct.
Are they just doing this with water, or are they trying to put all of the things we've been discussing into their building?
It's a building that relies heavily on daylight. It has an advanced mechanical system that delivers air under the floor, and then each workstation, so each worker has their own vent that they can control and adjust their own temperature and airflow, so everyone's a lot more comfortable. The building will generate 70% of its own power using a turbine inside the building. A lot of attention to the materials and daylighting throughout the building to really make it a much more pleasant and comfortable place for the people working in that building. Plus enormous energy savings and operational savings building that way.
Now, weren't you involved in making the White House greener?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a project that started in the 90s, and some of that work is ongoing.
Why is it taking so long?
Well, it's a huge complex, and you don't try to do everything all at once. When you've got an operating facility, you gradually put things in over time. So new windows, new lighting system, new mechanical system in the White House. A few years ago, photovoltaic, our solar cells were put on for part of the building, a solar hot water system for heating the president's swimming pool, new paint standards, increased recycling. All that saving taxpayers about $300,000 a year in energy costs and about $50,000 a year in water costs.
Well, if I ever have a swimming pool, I promise you that I will do everything possible to keep it as green as I can. I read that the U.S. government, with about 500,000 buildings across the country, accounts for 2.3% of the energy use in this country. That's $10 billion, a utility bill that the taxpayers have to pay. Are there plans to make the whole, all federal buildings green?
Yes.
There's a lot of work in the federal government. A number of 23 agencies last year signed a memorandum of understanding saying that they wanted to use the LEED rating system, and a number of agencies actually mandate the use of the LEED rating system to the, not the first level, but actually the second level of performance. It's called LEED Silver. And what we're seeing in the buildings coming in rating in the LEED system, they're averaging about 32% energy savings over baseline performance.
Now, Jamie, does green mean something different than sustainable?
No, I would use the two interchangeably.
Would I recognize a green building if I walked by? Would there be certain things that would clue me into it?
If you were, to the casual observer, I would say no. You might notice photovoltaics on the facade. You might notice some shading devices on the windows, on the exterior. But in general, I wouldn't think you would notice it. You would probably notice, maybe perhaps, an inefficient building by looking at it, by noticing the poor orientation or the amount of glass used on it. So that might be a giveaway.
So were buildings greener before we got into this glass curtain style of architecture that became popular, I guess, from the 30s on?
Well, probably a little later than that. But certainly buildings prior to the advent of indoor air conditioning were greener because their energy consumption per square foot was less. They were designed using H-shapes and I-shaped cross-sections or U-shaped with air shafts. So they had small, shallow floor plates which allowed daylight to almost everyone within the building and ventilation through operable windows throughout the floor space. These buildings generally have a lot less energy use because of that, whereas today's buildings, with the advent of artificial light and air conditioning, you can build these 35 to 45 foot plan depths from the elevator core to the perimeter wall and then condition the entire space.
And I've worked in any number of buildings where you couldn't open the window.
Right.
Now, you Bill, well, you...
Or you couldn't adjust a vent either. There was no way to control your temperature. And so with modern glass, too, in the last 20 years, glass technology has undergone an amazing revolution. things like what are called low-E coatings, low-E emissivity coatings. It's a very, very thin, visually invisible light coating that blocks infrared transmission. And so coatings like that and other advances have dramatically increased glass performance. So that's why you're able to see things like the Bank of America Tower, which is basically an all-glass building, but still is a high-performance building because of those advances in glass technology.
You worked with Buckminster Fuller. Was he concerned about these things?
Bucky was really concerned about materials use, materials efficiency, and energy flows. He saw it all as a condition of how we live on the Earth, and he popularized the term Spaceship Earth, and he said, look, here's the spaceship we've been given, this is what we're journeying through the universe on, and we better operate it well, or we're in trouble.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take your calls and this discussion of going green, because I'm sure all of us would like to do something. The Bank of America is not building an environmentally green building simply because it wants to be good, although that may be a reason. This is also a way to save money, so you can do good and save money at the same time, which is part of what we're dealing with here on today's Please Explain, talking with Bill Browning, a founding member of the United States Green Building Council's Board of Directors, and Jamie Backus, a lead accredited professional engineer. Our number, 212-433-9692. Stay with us. And we're back with Please Explain, talking about green buildings with Jamie Backus, who lectures at New York Designs at the City University of New York and at Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation, and Bill Browning, a principal in Terrapin Bright Green, a strategic environmental consulting firm. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to those calls, Jamie, are we now at something of a tipping point? Because it seems as though there are many more people involved in building green buildings than there were in the past. And I know that just in casual conversations with people, they're starting to talk about what they can do to save electricity, whereas in the past they probably would have shrugged at a conversation like this and said, well, that's for somebody else.
Certainly over the last few years, we have seen much more attention paid by mainstream media to the issues of either climate change or green buildings.
And so media attention, really, to affect this change?
It seems like the vice president's movie has helped. Lectures that I give, I remember some of the questions were informed, but since then, since the advent of that movie coming out, I get a lot more people who have read up before they come to a lecture and ask the most intelligent questions. And I think that is a sign that mainstream press coverage is just growing.
Is that your perception as well, Bill?
Yeah, and I think it helps that we have more than 5,000 green buildings across the U.S. now. So there are many, many places where people can go see them and experience them. And that really, I think that helps as well. The economist Kenneth Boulding used to say, what exists is possible, and we can now go see what's possible.
Well, it's not just buildings. Aren't there green planned communities now?
There are. There are some very amazing ones. There's one in a redevelopment of an army, of a military base in Charleston, South Carolina, called Noisette, that is quite amazing. An old industrial site in Victoria, British Columbia, called Docksides Green, that are just incredible places.
And green buildings, in and of themselves, are only part of a solution, Leonard, that you really need to have a green community. Because once you leave your building, no matter how green it is, your lifestyle is within that building, if you jump on the subway or jump in your car and you get back into a regular society or a community that is based on inefficiency, you're stopping what you were already doing good.
But isn't it easier to do this sort of thing in a suburban or country setting because you can have wildlife corridors, you can have all sorts of other things. It's easier to put solar panels on your roof than it is if you're in an apartment building. No?
True. But I think the density of being able to have everyone in an area like New York City and use mass transportation is a huge factor of why New York City is so green inherently, that by spreading out and requiring subdivisions of communities where everyone is taking their own personal vehicle to get to and from, that we no longer have walkable communities that we used to see. There's no sidewalks anymore. Then you're getting in a car and putting out 20 pounds of CO2 per every gallon of gas.
There's one building in New York, the Solaire, a residential building, that even gives you cleaning products when you move in.
Sure. We talked about that earlier when they created a green building in Battery Park City, the Solaire, and it was one of the first high-rise residential green buildings, certainly in the country. And they took all these painstaking efforts to remove indoor contaminants when they constructed it, and they don't want you coming in and just using your old household cleaning products. They give you things that are off-the-shelf products that are inherently designed so that they don't have the chemicals in them.
So how do we find out about those products? If they're off the shelf, that means that I can go to the supermarket and buy them, but I don't necessarily know which ones are good and which ones are not. Are there lists somewhere? Is there a website I can go to?
There are definitely blogs in various places. And in fact, the Solaire, run by Albanese, would be happy to share with you their suppliers' information so that you could buy them, because they make that available to all the residents within the building.
Go ahead.
But you could certainly start looking for it in your store near you. And if they don't have it, then I would say in New York City, you could certainly walk around and find a health food store or someplace else that would carry a similar product.
Well, I do go to the supermarket and look for those things, and it's invariably about 10 times more expensive than ones that say environmentally safe.
I have never been paying that kind of a premium. But it certainly, even if it were 10 times more expensive, Leonard, how much do you pay in health care a year?
Let's go to Tom from the Upper West Side.
Hi. I wanted to make a plea for having the LEED credits be applied to existing buildings. I mean, I live in a building on the Upper West Side which has, I don't have air conditioning. I live by ventilation. I mean, and also in the question of the advantage of living in cities, if your buildings are stacked up, you have much lower heat loss or heat gain when you're compact than when you're spread out on houses.
But okay, so what do you think, Bill? Older buildings may be LEED compliant even if they never really were assessed that way?
Well, in fact, there is a version of LEED called LEED for Existing Buildings that's used to help people figure out what kind of measures to implement on an older existing building. And we see folks like the Rudin family in New York using that on some of their properties. And it is a way of looking at the operation of the building, energy, indoor air quality, materials, and all of that for an existing building.
Thank you so much for your call, Tom. Jim from New Jersey, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Thank you for taking the call. Listen, I'm in the carpet business, and I'm writing specs constantly for architects trying to achieve gold and silver LEED accreditation. And a problem that I run into, and I have never found the answer for this, is most carpets that go in commercial buildings have nylon face. Some carpets only have nylon face. And for that, you get no LEED credit points. Yet if you add a PVC backing, which has a percentage of recycled content in the PVC, then you can get LEED credit. So by adding a component, by building a component that is PVC, a toxic product, but because it has recycled content, LEED will give you credit for that, but not if you didn't use the toxic backing with the percentage of recycled content.
Jamie, are you aware of that?
I'm not specifically aware of that. Bill, are you familiar with that backing criteria?
Well, there are some of the major manufacturers are making nylon with recycled content in it. Antron does that, and a few of the others. And one of the things to look at is that the face fibers are incredibly energy intensive to make, and so that's one of the places where looking at how the carpet industry is asking questions about recapturing those fibers and recycling them. And number of companies have been trying to look at that and also look at the backing as well, the components of the backing and how it's made. And several of the manufacturers are now reclaiming and remaking the backing as well. So the carpet industry is one that has, in over the last 10 years, really helped lead a lot of the conversation in commercial interiors and residential interiors about changing manufacturing process and what they're doing.
Leonard, the U.S. Green Building Council is a consensus-based group of every industry, manufacturer, engineers, architects, building owners. Every component of the building industry is represented. And the LEED rating system is an ongoing, growing, continually updating set of standards. And there are some credits that aren't quite right, but we're working on that. And it's, again, it's a weighting system that's always subjective.
Let's go to Kathy from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been looking for an environmentally responsible refrigerator and couch, and I'm very frustrated because in New York City, the size and dimensions of appliances are often very critical. I'm finding that the Energy Star ratings are incomplete, and also in the situation of couch, it's ridiculous how hard it is to get the information about energy or about environmentally responsible couches. And I'm just wondering, and they're also very expensive. So I'm wondering what you can, if you have any ideas.
Well,
I'll take my hand drop line.
Refrigerators, there's a great book that's put out by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. It's a nonprofit, and they update it every few years, and it's called Consumer's Guide to Home Energy Savings. And in it, they list all sorts of different appliances by size and by functionality, and then what's the most efficient available in that size and that functionality. So a side-by-side refrigerator or a refrigerator on the top or a freezer on the bottom, all sorts of washers and dryers and water heaters, all sorts of stuff. And that book's a great resource, and they update it every few years. And I would recommend getting a copy of that.
Thank you for your call. We go now to Liz from the Upper West Side. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I was wondering, you were speaking the other day about fluorescent lighting, the new bulbs that are purchased. What about halogen lighting? Is that energy conserving?
I would say not. You're going to look at most halogen bulbs, and you're going to see a 300-watt lamp. So if that is... If you're using that to light your home and it's a 200-square-foot room and you could do the same thing with a compact fluorescent that might be 15 watts, then I'd say no, it's generally not.
But what about fluorescent lights? For a long time, we were told that they weren't as good for our eyes. Have they been improved in recent years?
Well, several things have happened with fluorescents. One, they're getting much better at the color rendition. They have gotten – the biggest problem with older fluorescents was they were on – magnetic ballast, which meant they were always flickering just right at the edge of perception.
Mm-hmm.
And with electronic ballast, that gets rid of the hum and all of the flicker. And so that really, that was the crucial issue on the problem with eyes with old fluorescents. So if you're using electronic ballast, that pretty much takes care of that issue.
Jundi from Morristown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, hello. Well, I have a question for recommendation. If the gentleman could recommend some sources for green builders in New Jersey. We are planning a renovation at a level to our home, which is a tiny little bungalow from the late 30s or 20s. And we have these ideas about recycling our existing beams from the roof and maybe try to reuse the cedar shingles and things like that. And all of the people, builders who we've spoken to before, they are looking at us like we are insane.
Right. Well, check with your, and there are more than 70 chapters of the U.S. Green Building Council around the country. And check with your local chapter, and they probably, within their membership, there's probably a builder in there or two. And then also check with the American Institute of Architects for the local committee on the environment, and they can probably tell you which builders they're working with.
Now, how difficult is it if you already have a building that is far from green but you want to make it green to convert it? You have a central air conditioning system. You may have a flat roof, but no idea of how to put solar panels up there. There is no way of capturing water. Does this take major renovation, or are there some pretty easy things that you can do?
Boy, the first thing I do is go out and get a caulk gun. Get a caulk gun and get some weather stripping and get a blanket for your water heater. And then you can...
That conserves energy, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff, basic weatherization, changing to efficient shower heads and efficient faucet aerators, all those sorts of things will usually cut the energy use of a standard house by maybe 30 to 35%.
And that's something that an apartment dweller here in New York City could do easily, except for the water heater, perhaps.
But Jundi's question makes me think about how we can really change things. And it seems to me it really involves convincing the people who do the work and the people who build the buildings to change their attitude in many cases. Is there a way of convincing them that it actually might be more cost efficient to try new approaches, or are they just so stuck in their old ways?
There are definitely cost arguments that you come up against with developers with any new technology almost. The onus is on us to prove that there's a payback to these types of building construction methodologies and systems. And certainly when you start looking at energy consumption of a standard HVAC system versus a much more efficient one, there might be an initial first cost penalty to buy the system, but the payback is within a couple of years depending on how efficient it really is. And that's something that we can easily study.
I want to thank both of you so much for being on Please Explain today. I've been talking with Jamie Backus, a lead accredited professional engineer who lectures at New York Designs at the City University of New York and at Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation, and Bill Browning, founding member of the United States Green Building Council's Board of Directors, principal at Terrapin Bright Green. On Monday's show, a look at the role serendipity has played in some of the most important medical discoveries of the 20th century. And then cookbook writer Joan Nathan with our matzo ball recipe swap results. Plus, Alfred Molina on the new film The Hoax about Clifford Irving and his invented biography of Howard Hughes. And then Congressman Charles B. Rangel, the new chairman of the powerful Ways and Means Committee, relates his experiences growing up in Harlem, fighting in the Korean War, and finding his way in politics. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Barbara Kahn, Tess Hartman, and Samantha Morgenstern. Tim MacArthur was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.